one more time.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Hey Kids Comics. You find us in the middle of a story arc called the Comicades.
We're coming off the dead center.
There. You know what's really funny is, by the way, I'm Andrew Farmer, your host. With me, as always, is my producer and hetero life mate, the Jedi Cole Houston.
Good evening, everybody.
You know what's really funny is we've talked in the past about how our method to a story arc, where we come in super fresh and hot, we feel good, we feel great, we nail the first one, just nail it, and then the second one, we're like, all right, we can try some new things, we're feeling experimental, you know, we're feeling good about it, so we try some new things in the second one. By the third one, we're like, we got this, we don't even need to try anymore, we'll phone it in.
Which is odd, because the third one, we bring in a guest.
Usually, yeah, well, we're phoning
it
in.
We didn't need any help, but yeah, that's true, so we needed somebody with some fresh opinions.
And then by the fourth one, we wake up and realize we still got two issues left.
Yeah, we gotta snap to it. We don't have any help on this one.
And then the fifth one, we're sprinting for it. We're giving it everything we got. We got rubber legs. We're leaving it on the track. Which,
this is, if we're building next issue, you guys, it's gonna be dynamite.
Well, what's really funny is we've explained that in the past multiple times. This story arc and the way that we're describing the decades of comics really falls into that. That really falls in line with that, because we talked about the 70s, where everybody was fresh and coming in hot, and they had a bunch of great ideas, and they were putting them out there, and then they got real experimental in the 80s, and were trying to do some things, and then the 90s.
They could do that was new.
Yeah, and then the 90s, they basically just, you know, drove it into the ground, and then we're coming into the aughts now, where they realize that they still got two more decades to go, and they better wake up and put some content on the paper. So that's where you find us. You find us coming out of the 90s, which was a fiasco. I'm not going to call it a disaster, but it was a fiasco. And into the aughts. And what we did last time was we kind of went back over the period before and discussed what the things that we wanted to discuss but didn't have time or slipped our minds. So, Cole,
absolutely.
Do you have anything to...
And part of the problem with this is there's so much to talk about. We could never in an hour be able to, especially, you know, we're talking about an entire 10-year period, mm-hmm. At least until next issue, where we only have to talk about a 4-year period.
That's right, that's right.
A 5-year period. But, yeah, this is the one where we really... you know, the 90s brought, for all the gimmickry and stuff, one of the things that didn't come up was a really unique amalgam, a unique publishing scheme that was Milestone Media, which was an independent that joined forces with DC. So it was sort of like the dependent independent,
right?
If you will. And, you know, created this universe that was very hit and miss. You had a lot of stuff that was really good. Personally, I think the Static Shock,
yes,
of course, or Static became, you know, one of the big hits that, you know, survived beyond.
Well, now they're talking about a TV show starring Jaden Smith, of all people, Will Smith's son. Yes, the Karate Kid.
The thing that one of the ones that struck me because on its surface the title Icon or Icon and Rocket, depending on what point you were picking it up, just was blatantly, you know, Afro-American Superman.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, everybody was like, "Oh, it's Black Superman," and you know, for the longest, the folks that created it were like, "No, no, no," and then they're finally, "Yeah, it kind of is." But the thing about it is, it wasn't.
Right.
It was and it wasn't. Dwayne McDuffie,
brilliant,
had created one of the things I think people miss in this is, yeah, it, in so many ways, it's a blatant Superman. It's, you know, somebody else's Superman, the same way that Supreme or Prime or, you know, Prime. But, you know, you can, the list goes on and on. Everybody has touched the Superman icon in some way. They've all tugged on Superman's cape. As it were.
Yes, they have.
But what Icon did that a lot of people miss is with the addition of a sidekick, you had Superman and Batman.
You did.
Rolled into one character. And what was really amazing about this is it was very well written. And that's one of the things that people missed, because they didn't want to, no one could see beyond, oh, it's Black Superman. Well, yes and no, because one of the things that struck me when I started reading it, I decided, you know, I'm going to check this one out. As I tried to read all of them, and some of them were frankly dreadful.
Right.
But what Duffy did, or McDuffie did rather, was give you a street smart Robin, as it were, in Rocket. Because, you know, she sort of insinuates herself in his life.
She Tim Draked herself in pretty good there, yeah.
But she also had, you know, still had a day-to-day life that was still, you know, down at street level.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that was the neat thing, is you had this, you know, incredibly superpowered hero, and the sidekick still has to deal with things like getting pregnant.
Right.
And it dealt very well with teen pregnancy. In fact, the... And I realize I'm jumping back a decade here, but one of the things that really struck me was an issue where she confronts the father.
Yes.
And he says, how do you know it's mine? And she just lays him flat with a sucker punch. And he's like, what was that for? And she simply says, as she's storming off, how do you know it's mine?
Yeah, just whatever, dude.
That the suggestion was... You know, if you slept with me, you must have slept with a lot of guys.
Right.
And it was just such brilliant characterization, and it's a shame that that kind of got missed out on back then.
The thing about it for me was, I've always had an issue with Superman, and I like a comic book that has a humanizing effect, and I've never really felt that with a Superman book. Like, it's been very hard for me to get into a book about Superman on Earth, protecting Earth, saving Earth. What they've done, what McDuffie did so brilliantly, was keep that same idea, but through the simple fact that he was writing it as an African-American character and dealing with issues that an African-American character would have to deal with, humanize the character greatly. Because you don't get that in, you know, even though he was an alien, supposed outsider, you made him an affluent white man that somehow managed to do whatever he wanted on a you know, reporter's budget. But still, you know, so there was a lot of, and a lot of the Milestone books did that. They were, you know, like social commentary and satire based in a comic book world about real world issues and problems that people have to deal with.
You hear a lot of talk about how, you know, Marvel introduced the real world problems because, you know, Spider-Man has trouble at school and Tony Stark's a drunk. But it wasn't until like the 90s that you really got hardcore, and you got things like Astro City. That Image published, Kurt Busiek and Alex Ross and others, that were just amazing character studies. And it really explored what does it mean to be a superhero.
Well, and speaking of real world problems, coming out of the 90s and into the aughts, the comic book industry itself faced a lot of real world problems.
Yes, indeed. This is the point where the excesses of Marvel that began in the 80s.
Well, and DC. Let's not let them off the hook.
But Marvel was the most excessive, because as you're going from the 80s, flush with the power of the 80s, Marvel began to throw a lot of money into everything. And by the 90s, they began to imagine that they could control every aspect of their product, literally from the paper mill to the retail sale.
Right.
There was a period where they really thought that, and blinded by that ambition, you had the Marvelution, which toppled an industry almost. And so as we're going into the 2000s, Marvel is never admitting defeat, never admitting wrongdoing.
Right.
But they come back to the fold, as it were, sort of.
Right.
they allow themselves to be carried by Diamond because they pretty much wiped out any other choices through their own hubris. And meanwhile, they pay the ultimate price for just, you know, they threw money at everything. Let's buy a toy company. Let's buy a card company. Let's buy this. Let's buy they bought a paper mill, for God's sake.
Well, once again, what we were talking about was they brought in a bunch of, you know, money men.
Yeah.
And what did the money men tell them to do? Which was diversify and lock down every aspect of the industry. Well, we found out that doesn't work. You can't do that.
It may work if you're, you know, have a mining scheme.
Right.
Out, you know, gathering nickel deposits off the coast of Scotland, or you know, have a consortium like that. But that consortium model is not as universal as they imagined.
Not at all. No, not at all.
Not by a long damn shot.
Is this their blood comics weren't selling very well.
That's right.
Coming out of So they had an uphill battle, and really they didn't figure it out until the mid-2000s. They didn't get back on their feet, because what happened in the early 2000s was they had to declare bankruptcy, if I'm wrong.
Yes.
If I'm not wrong.
No, you're not wrong. They in fact, in early to mid-2000s, Marvel did go bankrupt, which was, I mean, it made international news. How could Marvel Comics, the number one publisher in the world?
This was the company that was going to fund both of my children's college, as well as buy me a new car and allow me to retire early. How can they?
Yeah, what kind of world do we live in? I think that was a very sobering time, because this is a period where the bubble had burst, and Marvel is paying that price finally. But and like you're saying, it wasn't just Marvel, but Marvel had the most reckless excess. They were just completely blind to anything but where can we draw in more money. And when they go bankrupt, it's like my father-in-law used to say that it's like the railroads. He would say the railroads, they didn't start making money until they went bankrupt.
Right.
And they started making some serious cash. But they also started to take a very serious look at what was going on. And the same thing, with less of a catalyst per se, was going on at DC. Well, everybody was taking a hard look at what were we thinking?
Well, Marvel was ground zero. And the thing about the bursting of the bubble was that it affected us before it affected the casual reader or the people that literally thought that they were going to fund, because I know people like this, people that thought they were going to fund their college funds.
Oh, yes. This was the term collector speculator was born.
Yes.
It was coined during the 90s, and the collector speculator died off.
Well, because, you know, we hear it first, and the thing that they lost first, and Marvel started it, but once that, you know, ground zero, once the big red button was pushed, we we've been feeling it, and we had been pushed away more and more as kind of their core fan base all through the 90s. We stuck with them, you know. Okay, we'll you know, because that's what we do, you know. I think that was a period in which you veered hard away from certain companies and books, and you went hard to DC and kind of ventured away from Marvel because of what they were doing. It was patently obvious what they were doing if you were, you know, if you had been reading comics for a long time. But those ripple effects don't hit your outside investor, your investor, your collector speculator for probably till 2002, 2003, when you start realizing when they go in to cash in their stocks, their war bonds, and realize they're not worth
exactly
anything.
I think, especially the Marvel bankruptcy, like I said, it was very sobering across the board. And it was a period where people were starting to, you know, decide, well, you know, I've got a huge collection. I've got, you know, 1,000 comic books. And they go and they figure they walk in with their truckload of comics, and they're told by comic shops, you know, I'm buried in these very books.
Right. Exactly.
There is no money here. I have too much of this already, and I see that in also, you know, as a toy collector, I see that a lot as well. Where just a few weeks ago, I was over at a toy shop in Dallas that specializes in aftermarket and current market toys, and was there just as a couple were begrudgingly repacking all the stuff that they brought in. And I got a glimpse at some of it, and a lot of it was sort of McFarlane stuff. And they were just told, you know, we've got too much of this already.
It's like the Spawn stuff and the...
Yeah, and like, you know, the Creech.
Oh, the Creech! Oh, man! The Creech!
I felt so bad for them because, you know, they're trying to you know, free up some space and probably make a little money, but there's nothing there that anyone wants.
Exactly,
anymore.
Yeah. So you had all that going on, and that spun itself into... You know, it was two-part. Like, there was a lot of flailing in the industry because what had happened was, obviously, the model that they were trying to base the business of comics on didn't work, and everybody knew it now. And so they couldn't fool anyone anymore into convincing them that these books were going to be worth all this money and that if they bought these chromium covers. I mean, we saw a pretty quick end to that.
They weren't printing gold anymore.
Yeah, we saw a pretty big end to that. Pretty quickly, the chromium, the variant covers, the, you know, in the spectrum that we were seeing them in, and they went back to DC. Kind of went there first. Marvel was still really trying to figure out where they stood and how they could get back flush. But DC kind of took advantage of that glut or that you know opening. And started making some really good books really early in the 2000s. And I think that and like you were saying before the show started, if you thought that the 80s were serious...
Yeah, it's funny. It was like, you know, the 80s sort of opened a door that the comic industry didn't go through wholeheartedly for another 10 years.
Right.
Granted, they did pass through that door quite a lot, but it wasn't until the 2000s, until the aughts or the double O's or however you want to call it, that you began to see a real push toward just not only throwing things out there and seeing if they flew, but throwing things out there for the newly created adult market.
Mm-hmm.
And I say newly created because one of the things that the glut brought us was the collector speculator who became a comic fan.
Yeah.
You had a lot of people who'd never set foot in a comic shop, and some of them actually bothered to crack the covers of their books, or perhaps they, you know, went back home with their tail between their legs
and cracked them open,
turned away, and decided, well, I may as well read the damn things.
The you know, what's and interesting, then, though, is the other thing that it brought us was the realization that gimmicks weren't going to sell comics anymore, so we had to lock it down and actually start putting some things on paper that people wanted to read and write good comics and draw comics well and bring in your best talent to get us out of this, you know, your crack staff. So, and we saw that, too. Sorry, I didn't mean to jump on
No, that's quite all right.
It popped into my brain. It just came out of my mouth.
That's right.
Stop it. But yeah, so go ahead. I'm sorry. So you saw people, the adults started to, the adult reader, the mature reader started coming into comics
and
droves.
Speaking of the mature reader, and speaking of things just sort of popping into your head, it was during the 90s, there was another glut that occurred that had escaped me until this moment. And that was the glut in the adult comic industry. We talked about this a year and a half ago or whatever it was back when we were doing From Funny Books to Graphic Fiction. We did the adult comics as a whole issue with Steve McCauley. And we talked about that a lot there, but there really was this sort of... There were enough, you know, what were once would have been known as underground comics were starting to come out to level ground, as it were.
Right.
And all of a sudden, you had not only a glut of little independent publishers, both brilliant and terrible, but you also had this huge push toward the dirty books.
Right.
And, you know, that created its own set of issues. But, this was a unique period, so and we do see that heavily on the decline by the 2000s.
Absolutely,
most of those books are long gone. You're not going to find Time Wankers. The import. I mean, I'm sure it's still running rampant in Europe, but there was a lot of import Japanese and European Milo Manara non Marvel stuff.
Right, right. If you knew what I mean.
Yeah.
What's funny is the other side of that is that you also, it's come full circle now. And what I mean by that is you now have books like Sex Criminals.
Yeah.
Or Just the Tips, which is the spin-off Sex Criminals book, where it's all awful sex tips. Like just stuff that makes no sense and isn't in any way like a Cosmo, to be taken seriously. But Sex Criminals is a brilliant book, and it's very adult, and it's done by Image, and you can pick it up at any comic shop. It's not like a Milo Manara,
Well, it's not like
comics
what these
with
would
three
be.
X's.
I mean, if you added a rating system, these books that, from the 90s would have ranged anywhere between X and triple X.
Right,
and,
right.
And even edged into quadruple X, which is kind of like the number 11 on the dial.
Right.
Because there were some of these that literally were...
like, whoa.
Yeah, they were dialing it up to quadruple X. there was a book called Boiled Angel where the guy, the author, the writer slash artist slash publisher... was actually, if I'm not mistaken, he may have been jailed,
really,
for issues number 7 and 8, which is on the cover was ATE.
Let's not forget.
But the judgment against him was he was not allowed to draw anything. Part of his probation was he was legally obliged not so much as scribble on a napkin.
Wow, it's like a computer hacker that they take their computer. You're not allowed to access the internet anymore.
Yeah,
type of situation.
And the thing about it was, it's interesting that all kind of bubbled to the surface, because one of the things I wanted to talk about was between the 90s and 2000s, we saw a ridiculous... I think the more comics came into the mainstream, the more they came under the scrutiny of people who had no idea what they were.
Yes.
Everybody was thinking, you had this mainstream... feeling that this perception that comic books were Archie and Little Lulu and Dot.
Right.
And, of course, the best expression of Dot ever was in a Simpsons thing where it showed, this cover of Dot. And it's like, I like Dots. And the big girl's going, I know. But, this is what people thought. And, Omaha the Cat Dancer and Boiled Angel,
existed
Casper
to say,
the Friendly Ghost or Richie Rich, these were not. And it got to the point where I'd have to look and see when it was founded, but it became necessary for the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund to become founded.
Yes, it did. Yes,
and
that is huge.
It was a huge thing because it says two things. It says, one, you have an industry that's not going to allow you to push it around. And a lot of people came forward, both in the industry and outside of the industry. A lot of legal minds began to say, no, this is wrong. You can't go and, suspend freedom of the press and freedom of expression,
right?
Because you feel like this is something that's not for kids, even though it was never marketed for kids. And personally, the one issue, especially as someone who was born and raised and lives here in the state of Texas, one of the most offensive cases that the CBLDF ever had to mm-hmm. field. And I haven't been able to track down what the final outcome was a situation where a Texas comic shop owner was jailed and fined for selling an adult-oriented comic book to an adult.
And it was Jesus Castillo, Castillo versus Texas in Dallas, and it was two counts of displaying obscenity. He was convicted for
books
one.
Even though were not on display.
Yes.
They were not open display. You had to ask for them. It was like that Monty Python sketch. What do you want? Dirty books? And,
But
you had to go out of your way to get to them. And yet the state, and it was one of these cases you see all too often in the legal system where the state or a county or, some prosecutor gets in too deep with something, and rather than admit defeat, they fight it to the bitter end.
It was Boiled Angels was
you were wrong.
94. Boiled Angels was 94. But the best part about it was the guy who Mike Diana, the guy who was convicted, had to do 1,248 community service hours, and he chose to do his 1,248 community service hours serving the comic book legal defense fund.
Nice.
Yeah.
Well played.
But you were right. It was into the 2000s when this stuff really started to kick up.
It was very late 90s or late 80s actually that the CBLDF was founded.
Right, but it didn't really.
It wasn't until the like the 90s and especially the 2000s where it just got stupid.
Well, also don't forget that so what we saw was this weird switch from the adult comics into this sort of semi-acceptable form of adult comics.
And that's the thing, you know, the adult comics, because there was such a glut of the dirty books in the 90s, it's hard for me to explain to people, you know, pick up Fables, it's a great adult comic, and they're immediately thinking, you know, a bunch of, like, you know, cat people humping each other. Like, no, that's not what we're talking about here. You know, that could happen in Fables, but you know, we're talking about books that are written for an adult audience.
But let's talk for a second about like companies like Xenoscope, who kind of folded out of the adult comics and went to the scantily clad comics.
Yes.
And, you know, you had a bunch.
There is that era.
Yeah, and that happened really heavy in the 2000s. But the thing about it was they figured out that you could do the Greg Land thing. You could speak to it. You could speak to a certain audience and still do a really good comic book, because like the Robin Hood comic is really, really good, and it does feature tight clothes, scantily clad, you know, 1980s Cinemax sex scenes with kind of muslin in front of the camera type things. But the comics are really, really good, and there's one that I wanted to look for that was very that because we saw what we often see in comics into the 2000s, which was people that grew up with your Vamprellas and your Evil Eddies and your Lady Chaoses sort of started reinventing them in their own image, but doing it in a way that they realized how ridiculous it was at the time and started making it into something completely, you know, completely different and interesting and weird, like Tarot, Witch of the Black Rose. Like, I don't know if you're familiar with Tarot or not. It's by Broadsword. Tarot features a character, and I say this with absolutely no, this is not, I'm not being histrionic here, has a haunted vagina. Okay, the character's vagina is haunted. Let's just, I'm putting that out there so that everybody understands there's a character in this book with a haunted vagina. And that's where we've gone to in this type of comics, is the haunted vagina. But outside of those adult comics, that kind of adult comic, we had, like you said, we had this glut of readers that are literally more adult, more mature, coming into the fold, and they've realized that they have to step their game up. So what did we get out of that? We got some really amazing comics that were targeted towards the mature reader. And even your licensed material, your material that has existed, your franchised material, your material with continuity grew up too.
Yes. Everything began to veer toward or not everything, but you know, you saw a greater emphasis on writing mature types of stories, writing smart stories, writing smarter.
Right.
And, you know, on the one hand, that did raise concerns of, you know, are we losing the young reader? Do we need to have something that's more teen friendly? But at the same time, you look at what they're writing in the, like, young readers' novels.
Right.
I don't know when, you know, if it was in the 2000s that it came out.
Well,
it probably was. But I remember going to, like, to Half Price Books when The Hunger Games came out, and being told that was, you know, to look in young readers. I'm like, what the hell?
We're verging on get off my lawn with your hula hoops and your Yannis and your Fitbits and your Snapchats if we're not careful. So,
no, what's going on?
But we got books. But we got books like All Star Superman and like the Captain America, the Steve Epting Captain Americas.
Yes.
You got books like like you were saying earlier, you got books like Identity Crisis, for God's sakes. You want to step it up into a place that's really adult.
Oh, yeah, and that's where you also start to see a new push toward hiring outside of...
Mm-hmm.
You're hiring novelists to write comic books.
You do see this thing where, because it's in the 2000s, you really start seeing guys like Brad Meltzer, who wrote Identity Crisis, who was a mystery novelist and a brilliant mystery novelist at that. But you also see Joss Whedon take over the X-Men.
Yes,
you see Richard Donner come back to Superman for a while. Which were some really good... I said I don't read a lot of Superman, but Richard Donner can do it justice. Kevin Smith comes on and writes Daredevil and some Green Lantern books.
And almost writes a Spider-Man story, I'm told.
Comes close. But you get... And then you get books from, like, Vertigo, which never shied away from adult-oriented books, but you get stuff like 100 Bullets... And an amazing, amazing kind of adult-oriented themed books that weren't superhero books.
Well, you also start to get these books that are just so complex.
Mm-hmm.
The aforementioned Fables, which I often refer to as the only thing Billy Willingham never put down. He was notorious for like starting something and you're just enamored of his brilliance and it just goes away.
Right.
And you're like, what the hell? I was just getting into that. And, you know, with Fables, he just won't stop. And what's amazing about it is if you pick up the first few and you fall in love with this thing, then you start to see this deeper... I mean, he's playing a long game here.
Yeah.
And there are things go on, you know, 12, 15, 30 story arcs in that the seeds were planted back in the first two or three story arcs. Like, what the hell? This is also, you mentioned Joss Whedon. This is a point where comics were really starting to come to their own, to the point where, his highly successful Buffy the Vampire Slayer and Angel are done. You know, they've been canceled. It's time to move on to other things for television. Well, what does he do? He teams up with Dark Horse and publishes Buffy the Vampire Slayer Season 8.
Brilliant.
And, yeah, which is a wonderful way of saying, you know, screw you. This is going to continue somewhere, and people flock to it because it was like reading Buffy the Vampire Slayer. If it had it, I will point out, because I've read Season 8.
Okay.
It's Buffy the Vampire Slayer, if it had an unlimited budget.
Which is awesome! Which is great!
Yeah. If you could do anything, and that's the beauty, yeah, of comics, is you have that unlimited budget, and Whedon takes full advantage of that fact. It's like, I'm going to step it up 10 notches,
and then,
because I don't have to care.
And then you got, like, Smallville Season 11, I think.
Yeah, exactly.
And because they realized, oh, we couldn't make him put him in the suit or make him fly in the show. We're putting him directly into DC Comics. We could do whatever the hell we want.
That's right. Hey, you know what? Guess what? Tights, flights, screw you.
Anything we want. But what you also got books like Why the Last Man, which was one of the most brilliant books that I think I've ever read.
Bizarre / brilliant books you can lay your hands on. Because I had the loan of like the first couple of 20 or so issues or something like that. And it was just like, this is so seriously screwed up, yet patently amazing.
Right.
Because it shouldn't make any sense at all, yet it makes perfect sense.
There were a lot of books as well that were kind of a reinvention, and you saw it in Marvel, and you saw it in DC, where it was kind of a reinvention and a pushback against authority and big business, and I really think that in some respects there was a lot of stuff involved there that could be considered. It's not pandering. I believe that it came from the inside, and it was honest. I believe that it was a reflection of what happened in the 90s. Things like
Absolutely.
Planetary and Irredeemable, Incorruptible, Invincible, all these books with this giant...
Oh, yes, Invincible was very good. I got in on several of the early issues of that, and it was very well written.
I want to talk real quick about we can talk about Marvel and DC all day and what they did after the 90s. But the one company that I think really came out of the 90s and embraced all of their faults and decided to make a huge change was Image. Image failed pretty wholeheartedly in the 90s. From inception through that decade, with every gimmick they could possibly get their hands on, because they were young, and they've come out since and said, because we're young, because we didn't know what we were doing, because nobody could tell us better.
Oh, yeah, and the one thing that Image did right at the outset was crawl into bed completely with Garib Sheamus and Wizard Magazine.
Yes.
Because nothing so becomes a young publisher, especially a young publisher publishing crap.
A rock star crap publisher, right?
Yeah, than to have, you know, Wizard Magazine effectively endorsing you like some kind of, you know, Art Linkletter on the cover of the Game of Life.
Well, and it's almost, and not to get too modern-y for people, but it's almost that Penguin and Gotham scenario where, okay, yeah, you went to them and said, we want you to, you know, we'll work with you, Wizard Magazine, but who was really pulling the strings here? You know, who was really saying, well, you should really do this. You should really put this out there. How many covers are you going to have? Because if you had more covers, we could give you more coverage in the magazine.
We could talk all about how brilliant you are.
Exactly. But at the end of their run through the 90s, coming into the aughts, they did something brilliant, which was admit their faults, which is something that neither side did. They said, we failed. We are going to go out of our way to do everything we can to make it better. And one of the things that they did was they brought on Robert Kirkman. And you can say whatever you want about Robert Kirkman. Robert Kirkman gave us one of the most popular independent comics and most socially aware comics that I've ever seen in my life as a comic reader, and that was Walking Dead. And if there was one thing that happened in 2000 that really set the tone for everything else that it was going to happen, it was the success of The Walking Dead.
Well, in fact, you know, Walking Dead was one of those things where, you know, it's playing a long game.
Oh, yeah.
And it's hard to get a publisher behind a long game type situation.
Mm-hmm.
You don't see that. It's, you know, it's very rare. That's what makes things like Starman or so many other titles, or like, you know, Fables and the like. Outside of Independence, which often didn't, you know, the publisher often didn't survive the book.
Yeah.
You have a hard time selling that, especially in the story arc, trade paperback-driven world of the bigger publishers.
Right.
So, you know, Image does that, and they also start doing, they take a page from Dark Horse and realize, become the vehicle for other people's work. I mean, that's what you were founded on, was creator ownership. Why not reach out to these creators and give them, I mean, so many indie published creator-owned properties jumped from tiny ships onto the Image bandwagon. At first glance, it was sort of like, why are you going to Image? It was like, well, of course you're going to Image. You know, a lot of people read it as, oh, they're selling out. Well, no, they're trying to find a bigger audience because they're good books.
That's the other thing
Image was, this was invitational.
Yeah.
You know, you didn't just like, oh, can you publish my book? No, you had to be pretty much invited.
Well, Image that's the other thing that Image did when they failed was they said, okay, we're going to throw open the doors and let you come to us and show us what you got. And if it's good, we'll put you under Image. And you can control most of what you're doing because that's what we were based on, and we're not going to get rid of that.
And I think, you know, this is a period where it illustrates in comic book form one of the things we've talked about on some of the shows on the JCU is that, you know, as podcasters, we went into this with the full knowledge that with very few exceptions, nobody gets genuinely famous as a podcaster. You're either already famous and you have a podcast, or, you know, you're one of the rare few who just happened to capture an unknown market.
Right place at the right
time,
guys.
Yeah, and in the same way, you know, web comics are a big labor of love because it's hard to get people to pay real money for something you're putting out on the internet.
Yeah, right.
So most web comics are just sort of a creative outlet. It's out there for anybody who wants to bother to look. And you have a unique situation with a webcomic called Player versus Player that got picked up by Image, and give a frame of reference to something more recent would be Axe Cop.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah,
where, you know, those are few and far between, but this is a period where the webcomic began to be taken seriously enough that years later, Axe Cop would be something somebody was looking at and saying, hey, you know, this would fly.
Well, and one thing the sleeping giant through all of this that got woken up, by man's ingenuity, as it were, was the internet. Happened
yes.
during all of this. And what that did was that allowed for things like the webcomic to come about. That also killed Wizard Magazine in a big way.
Yes.
Which, yeah, hooray, internet. it allowed for us to get news more quickly about what was happening. It allowed for leaks to happen. They couldn't rely on the same marketing campaigns that they were doing before. They had to evolve, and they had to catch up with what was going on.
The models had to change drastically.
Exactly, exactly.
But also what's funny is in the early days of the internet, the comic industry was running so scared of the internet that they missed out on so many opportunities. And I think what happened was once they stopped fighting it, once they stopped being terrified of the internet, and they began to realize that what the internet was a tremendous tool. It was like the best free advertising they could ask for.
Oh, yeah.
To the point that by this period, Marvel had completely abandoned promotional. Physical promotions. There was a time where Marvel and DC were churning out promotional material for their books at an alarming rate. I know, I used to collect this stuff.
You used to package it and collect it.
Yeah, I packaged it and collect it. But, by the time I had my shop, we were, like, there was not a week went by I didn't get 1, 2, 3, 10 promo posters, promo cards, promo something.
Right.
DC. In the 2 years we had the shop, in the 5 or 6 or 8 years, however long it was, I had to maintain a business.
Yeah.
Either the physical shop or as a retailer at conventions. During the time I had my business license, I got one Marvel promo poster.
Jeez.
One. Marvel had completely abandoned spending a penny on promotions. And I think in a lot of ways it was sort of quietly embracing the fact that fandom was going to do all its advertising for it.
Yes. We're so big that it doesn't matter, right?
Yeah. I mean, at that point they were so big, they were always going to be top dog.
Yes.
And, you know, another plus was the fact this is also the period where Marvel, fresh out of bankruptcy, now has the capital, the freedom to not only license out their material to the fact that that Hollywood had caught up with the superhero movie.
Right.
They also began to realize that, you know, when somebody backs the money truck up, they aren't necessarily going to treat your property with care.
Exactly.
And
they're going to want a piece of that pie.
And I think this was in the 90s, but it may have been the 2000s, was a Man-Thing movie, which couldn't have been Marvel's Man-Thing in name only.
It was done by, I believe it was done in association with the Asylum. It was for the Sci-Fi Channel, and it was horrific. It was the worst.
Oh, yeah. It was a dreadful thing, and that was a wake-up call, one of many wake-up calls that Marvel had during this period, and they realized that, you know, we need to stop being idiots, between that and the Roger Corman Fantastic Four, which was the, you know, I don't want it good, I want it Thursday.
Exactly.
Approach, because the license was about to run out, and by God, they were going to get something out of it, which turned out to be nothing. The Dolph Lundgren Punisher, which could not have been less about Punisher. And, you know, even though they had pretty much sold the farm on X-Men, Fantastic Four, and Spider-Man, they had a unique opportunity there where they could at least catch everything else.
And there were, there's
literally
a,
everything else.
They finally realized that there was a lot to catch. Like, that was the thing, is they didn't need, X-Men was big, but they didn't need, they had a stable of licenses, of franchises that remained untouched that they could finally do something with.
And also, they stopped just selling the rights.
Right.
You know, you want to make a movie about our characters, you'll foot the bill.
Right.
We'll get a piece of the action, but we also get creative control. And that kind of creative control is what gave you this amazing, you know, the phases of Marvel that we're seeing now that we, you know, quite frankly, marvel at. Because there's a concerted effort being put forth to make sure there's a quality, that there's a consistent dialogue, or, you know, a consistent continuity, consistency of quality, a consistency of an ongoing
right
theme, and that every one of these movies fit with all the others. And even if you have different directors and different visions, there's at least some underlying guidelines, and there's some control there.
And you know what? I remember the argument when Iron Man was first announced as the first Marvel movie from the Marvel studio that they had just put together. And there was this argument as to whether it would be viable, whether it would make any money, whether, you know, the character carried enough. Now, of course, you have Guardians of the Galaxy, which were almost completely unknown unless you were an actual, like, dyed-in-the-wool comic book fan. But
and that was the one, I think, that for the first time in a decade or more, anyone was questioning.
Right. But they questioned – I remember them questioning Iron Man, and I was sitting back like, are you insane? This is going to be brilliant. Like, how can this not be the best, you know, the best thing that I've ever seen in my life? It's all right there. They've got a complex, you know, character. They've got technology. They've got the technology to make it look – you know, there was this whole thing.
Exactly.
And – you know, but the other thing that we saw, and we talked about this, the 2000s are so much like the 80s, in that we took, it's like we had a drop decade in the 90s, and the 2000s picked up where the 80s left off in a really good way, because we got back to the basics of a lot of the archetype comic books that we didn't have before. In a good way, because like you said, the creators got to control a lot of what they were doing. So you had guys like Ed Brubaker making crime comics that were brilliant. You had good war comics again. You had sci-fi comics. You had fantasy comics that you could go out and buy that had the soul of the creator in it, and it wasn't a marketed, grouped, crowdsourced thing anymore. It was what comics were supposed to be. And I think that by the middle of the 2000s, you saw a lot of the people who gave up halfway through the 90s start coming back to the medium.
This was also, you know, we talked about like Identity Crisis.
Yes.
This is also a period where you start to see let's knock out one blockbuster after another.
And, yeah.
And that was, in many ways, hit and miss, because, you know, sometimes it hit, and it hit hard. and sometimes it missed, and it missed miserably.
Exactly.
Things like World War Hulk, I think.
Didn't hit as hard as they thought that they were going to.
Yeah. As I think they were trying to ride the coattails of,
Well, you know, they had some, and that's the other thing that we saw. When Marvel finally realized that they had overstepped their bounds with their fans and with people that had invested real money and time into them, you know, the foundation for who they are was destroyed. So they had to restart. And in 2004, they did it in such a big way that it brought me back to Marvel after. What, when did 95, 96, when they started the Age of Apocalypse Heroes Reborn thing, is when I said, nope, I'm done, Marvel. I'm done.
Exactly.
I'm out. But they did the Avengers Dissembled.
Yeah, this Dissembled was one of the big ones where they're it starts the shakeup, where it's like, and there's like the annual shakeup over at Marvel.
Mm-hmm.
So you have Avengers Dissembled, then you have the ludicrously ponderous House of M. Then you have Civil War, which was literally the shit for an entire
year. And some of it was literally the shit. Some of it was good, but some of it... But that's the thing is, what I see this is as Marvel literally scaling everything down. You know, they salted the earth essentially, and then picked up and moved somewhere else and started their colony over again. Because in Avengers Disassembled, they took out all of the Avengers. In House of M, they took out all of the essentially all of the Avengers, all of the mutants. In Civil War, they essentially, you know, turned everything on its head and took away everything that you knew about their universe. And they did it in not a that it was their version of a one of DC's crises. But it took three years.
In fact, very much like Crisis, because what Civil War did was allow you to bring like every damn hero ever. Every character in the entire Marvel Universe was, you know, pulled out of the mothballs. Because simultaneously what they did with their non-Earthbound universe was Annihilation.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, let's bring the Guardians of the Galaxy to the fore. Let's mix that up. Let's bring Galactus and Annihilus and, you know, probably Blastar and you know, anybody
had,
who
Blastar was in there. Drax was in there.
Drax and Surfer, Ron Accuser, and like all the old Kirby Hall of Famers, and let's bring these guys back out and let's remind people that these characters are there. Let's make them new and viable,
right?
And it just didn't stop. Marvel's plan was just like, you know, it was just like batting practice.
It
was just like this, you know, one of those tennis ball throwing machines that just shot one thing after another, and a lot of them were just really big hits, but all of them served a purpose, even the ones that kind of flopped in many ways, and that was to get people aware of everything going on. DC, real hit and miss during that period with 52.
Yeah.
It was a very curious approach. It was an annoying numbering system, as we've talked about in the numbers game. You're following the Infinite Crisis with this really kind of difficult thing to get into because you were forced to buy 2,000 comics in the course of a year.
Well, what they were doing was they were leading up to what we know now was the new 52.
Yeah.
That all the last
half. They knew where things were going to happen.
But we didn't. So what it became, because somewhere in their writer's retreat, they came up with this idea. And they're like, well, we have to get there. So we have to set everything up to be there.
Yeah,
so how do we do that?
This is Hong Kong. This is the Panama Canal. You know,
exactly.
There's a date that this is going to hit.
So
we can't drag our heels anymore.
So for them, it was very exciting. For us as readers, it became exhausting to the point of you gave up because you couldn't keep up. Like you they wanted to build suspense, and what they did was they built Battleship Potemkin suspense, where it was just like, oh, okay, we get it, you have more than one camera.
You can go from suspense, you can tip from suspense into monotony quite easily.
Right. It's if you were to keep it
in
two or three books.
There's only so many steps the baby carriage can go down before it starts.
Exactly. Before you're like, oh my God. Before it becomes a Family Guy sketch.
What the hell? How many thousands? This is like one of those...
This is M.C. Escher's Battleship Potemkin.
Is this like an Inca temple or something? How many steps does this monument have? And how did that woman get up there in the first place?
But it was obvious.
Was the baby born up there?
It was obvious that they were attempting to set something up for like 5 years.
Yeah.
It started in Infinite Crisis, and it didn't end until... Because... And at the same time... Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Oh, that's the reason they did the backward numbering, is because ultimately it was retrospect.
It was hubris.
You could only understand this in retrospect, so they numbered it backward, because that's exactly, you know, when it would start to sink in was in reverse.
But then they decided, since we're in this period, right, and I have to do this because it broke me. It broke me on the Green Lantern, because then they decided to become, in the last part of the aughts, DC decided to become...
Between the aughts and the tens.
They decided that they were going to be Green Lanterns. They were going to become the home of all holes filled with Green Lantern.
That's right.
So you had the rebirth of Green Lantern, you had the war of, you know, you had all of this stuff about how all these different spectrums exist that no one knew about for...
Yeah, apparently for the last 100 years, we've been patently unaware Abin Sur went to his death
with his knowledge,
realizing
right.
how many lanterns there were.
And those little blue bastards weren't giving up any information over on Oa. Right. So you got everything leading up and culminating in Blackest Night and Brightest Day, which was, you want to talk about just something that went from a really interesting idea, although it did capitalize on Cole's favorite thing to talk about in a way that was awful, which was the zombie movement in everything.
Oh, yes. Well, if there's anything Kirkman did well, that was to revitalize in the way that Romero had in films. It brought the zombie back, and everyone and everything was... Zombies became, in the 2000s, the ninjas of the 80s.
It's true. It's so true.
Because everybody had ninjas. I mean, if Eastman and Laird had been, young adults at this period of time and pooled their money, it would have been teenage zombie, Teenage Mutant Zombie Turtles.
Movie producer. But you had the Marvel
the
Zombies.
The whole world turned into Full Moon Studios.
You had the Marvel Zombies over on Marvel's side, which at least they kept it out of continuity.
Yes, they have to give them that much.
But DC decided to not do that and have Blackest Night, which was twofold. Number one, they got to bring all the zombies in the world in. Number two, they got to showcase characters that they haven't been able to showcase in 10 years since the last Crisis by bringing back zombie Hawk and Dove and zombie Vibe and the zombie Wade.
Or even like zombie Cole, K-O-L-E, who was a member of the Teen Titans for like a day, and then mm-hmm. she gets snuffed out in the Crisis because no one could figure out exactly how to write a character whose power was to like weave crystal out of thin air.
Right.
Is a potentially dynamite, especially for certain anniversaries and for any wedding.
Right, right.
You think people would just be lining up.
She just missed.
You make me a vase or, I make slides and things to help people.
She just missed two things that would have really, she would have been the Maxwell Lord of the DC Universe if she just would have made it to cell phone covers and Hello Kitty. If she just could have made it that long to where she could have made cell phone covers and Hello Kitties, she could have been the new Wayne Foundation. She would have made so much money on her superpower. But no, she couldn't have made it that long.
Cole, I want to... This is my cosplay challenge. This is a character. I personally love it when I'm at a convention and somebody goes to trouble to fabricate a costume of a character nobody thinks of anymore.
Right.
And I think, I would love to see Cole and Aqualass. Or Aquagirl, rather. Aquagirl.
I've been waiting for a really good Willy Lumpkin that's never come.
That's so true. That's so easy to do, especially if you're a postal official.
Yes.
If you're a postal employee. If you're gaunt and have a mustache, so much the better. If you're elderly, and especially if you can wiggle your ears.
So we're coming out. Okay, so we got to start wrapping it up. We're coming out of the 2000s. We ended well. We ended at the end with the zombie craze and the 2000s came out of the 90s and greatly improved the industry for the readers, and I think the industry in and of itself. It embraced new media. We saw more TV shows coming. We definitely saw the movies coming. I think everybody ended the 2000s with a lot of hope in the comic industry.
Well, also there was so much more. Again, this is one of those things when the comic industry stopped whining about the advent of the internet.
Right.
And granted, the internet seemed like, it was like, the novel Childhood's End or something. It was like some great extraterrestrial force had come and just changed everything.
Right, or some Orwellian nightmare.
There was that period of about 3 or 4 years where some people became millionaires, and some people became millionaires and then quickly became very poor.
Right.
Because, we thought that the internet was going to rule the world. And the shrewd people stayed enough away from it that, for about 6 weeks I was buying my groceries online. That got kind of tiresome not to have a level of choice.
Right, it became the blackest night of...
Self-determination. It became almost like an episode of Star Trek.
It's like a Seinfeld...
demand my freedom.
Seinfeld meets Star Trek over here.
Yeah. So, you know, once they stopped worrying and not only embraced the internet, but also embraced the fact that technology had caught up, that production of everything was patently simpler and cheaper.
Right.
Then you start to see an embracing of media, and you have the film and the television branches of these companies starting to make smart decisions to get their stuff out in front of people
and work together.
Granted, this was before the 2000s, I'm pretty sure, but you know, if Nightman can get a television series,
oh yeah, Nightman. There have been a dearth. I'll tell you this: since Nightman, since the 90s, there has been a real dearth of or a real absence in my life of superheroes that are both mulleted and play the saxophone. So somebody,
there's another challenge. We want to see a return.
A Nightman cosplay. If anybody can do a Nightman cosplay or mantis,
especially if you're like the saxophonist in your marching band,
right? And you can actually play.
Yeah, it helps if you can get up on stage and actually belt out a tune.
But yes, it was. You're absolutely right. You know, and we started to see them more in the next episode of the show, more in the next issue than this one, but you start to see them sort of start to work together. You see comics, toys, movies, and TV shows being released in conjunction with each other.
Absolutely, because I think as an industry, they began to remember, hey, remember back in the 60s?
Right.
The Batman TV show, which had nothing to do with Batman, with what was going on in the comics, but the comics began to like quadruple in sales.
Yeah, exactly.
For a long-ass time. I mean, people weren't getting what they were seeing on television two times a week when they went to the grocery store and bought a copy of Batman or Detective, but they went back and bought more Batman or Detective.
Exactly. Over and over.
And, you know, it seemed like, you know, there would be, like, the Superman the movie comes out, and Superman sales skyrocket, and all these things, you know, and all these different periods. But no one ever sat down and realized, you know, if we kept this up, it would be that good for people all the time. Because I guarantee you, you know, 90% of the people walking in to see Guardians of the Galaxy had no idea about any of the comics.
No, not at all.
Would be shocked if they went and looked at the original Guardians.
Oh, man.
where's the little fuzzy guy? Where's the plant guy?
Right.
They'd be shocked to know that Groot was originally from Monsters on the Prowl or one of those type of books.
One of the monster books, yeah. Absolutely.
But, you know, when you get that realization that if we consistently get stuff out in front of people, embrace the fact that home video is a big thing now.
Yeah.
It's a major market. And you begin to embrace the fact that we publish this comic, but we're owned by a movie company.
Right.
Then you know, DC begins to pull their heads out of their asses and flourish a bit. So you do see this. It's a coming of age. It's an awakening.
Exactly.
In the industry in a whole different way, and they realize, you know, there are other ways to make money at this game.
Yeah, everything starts to get, you know, business-wise it gets better. We as comic fans are getting more of what we want, and one of the things that we want, and especially us on this show, is for more people to read comics. So So nowadays you've got every way to direct people to read comics. And you know, I was one of the initial people, and I don't know when this happened, but it's got to be the late 2000s, early teens, where, you know, you started to have your digital comics start to be foisted upon us. And that was
the thing that for the longest everybody thought that's where the industry is going to head. It's inevitable. It has to. If it wants to survive, it has to go digital. And it did, but yet the paper one never went away, because what they were suffering from was cable television, mm-hmm. and home video to the movie theater. Mm-hmm. And the movie theater was going to die and go away. And nobody, who would want to go see a movie in a theater when they can watch it in the comfort of their own home?
Exactly.
And now we see, you know, 25-screen megaplexes being built. We see, you know, movie theaters like in Amsterdam where you can order a glass of beer. And, you know.
Well, yeah, I mean, and what we had.
And this is new stuff.
But what we saw was an evolution in the comic books, because I was one of the first one that jumped on board and was anti, if you remember right, and I think it was back in the collector sector days, I was anti-digital, because DC went on their thing.
I'm vehemently anti-digital.
But the thing that it did for the comic books was they had to once again up their game. They had to once again better art, better, not so much better writing, but a better product that made people want to buy it at a store level and have it as a possession versus having something on a digital device. So you got this thing in the late 2000s, and we really need, I know I said it before, but we really need to start wrapping up. You got this thing in the late 2000s where they said, all right, well, how do we do that? Let's do variant covers, but let's not do it the way that we did it before. Let's do it in a smart way that isn't overly expensive, that we're not expecting to drive people, you know, we're not giving the implication that people will be able to get these variants and pay their way through college or anything like that. But what we'll do is we'll offer in-store variants only that'll be thematically, you know, so we'll have Halloween ones or we'll have Jack Kirby ones. Like there's currently a Jack Kirby variant cover across the board. Like every book will have a certain type of variant cover. So if you want that, and you can only get that if you go into a store and buy it. So you could have it for your collection, and it's fun, and it's for the collector, not just the reader. So they got smart about how they were going to angle that, and the art got a lot better, and it's something you want to have in your, you know, to open and read, and versus having it on
the thing.
Yeah, and
it's funny, because the variant cover also became less about you know, throwing a bone to the retailer. Like, here's something that, you know, we're going to make 1 in 100 is going to be this cover. Or, you know, for every 50 the retailer buys, he can get this one because he can make up his money by selling it to some hack for, you know, some inflated price. It became something that was accessible, but it was a fun, you have a choice.
Mm-hmm.
It was more about giving you, the collector a choice of which cover.
Well,
you know, you wanted to see when you pulled out your back issues to read.
DC just did a thing, because DC's been doing really fun ones, just straight up fun. They did a Halloween one recently, and the Halloween ones were cool. It was all monsters. It was whatever the key player in that book. If it was Green Lantern, it'd be Green Lantern. But they would be monster covers. So you had like Sinestro as like a weird Minotaur devil or whatever. They were fun. But one of them they did that was just fun, plain fun, was they did a selfies one. So you got like Batman driving the Batmobile and Damian Wayne over here taking a selfie of him, and Batman's just scowling, you know, and Damian's gonna they're just fun. Thank you for making comics fun again.
He wanted to send a selfie to his peepaw.
Yeah, it's Peepaw.
Rajal Ghul.
That's weird. I don't want to ever refer to Rajal Ghul as somebody's Peepaw. But
I've been doing it for a long while on this show.
That's weird. But I know, but it's still weird. So what we saw was the 2000s started off, people were, the industry was floundering, it got very serious, and at the end it kind of found its footing, and it realized it could still be serious and have fun, and that it brought the fun back, and thank you for bringing the fun back and being inventive again. So, okay, we're closing it.
Also, you know, just to...
No, go ahead.
No, this will help us close out, because bring people, like you say, it brings people back in the fold and gives people the opportunity to have an incentive to, as we say, read, collect, and enjoy.
And enjoy your comics. Sorry, I had to be the vile taskmaster that I am there for a second. Yeah. Like, the trains will run on time! So why don't you plug us up and we'll get out of here.
All right, yes. And thank you, everybody, for this has been an absolute treat. We got one more decade or semi-decade to get through yet, which we're going to just go nuts with. But we're coming to you, of course, through the Jedi Cole universe, JediCole.com. You can find us on the Twitter, @TheJediColeU.
Right.
You can write to us at jcumail@yahoo.com. And in, depending on when this airs.
Quick math.
Last week, we might have had our third issue of Hey Kids Comics Live, which you can check out the archive of all issues of Hey Kids Comics Live, both at the JCU website and, of course, on the home of Jedi Cole Universe, of Hey Kids Comics Live, which is, of course, deepelemonair.com, where we are very privileged and honored to be able to bring you a live show on the second Saturday of every month And they will all, the trains will be running on time. Finally, they will, in fact, all be on the second Saturday of every month from
there
now
on. There you go. We'll catch back up. Exactly. That's right. Daylight savings time, right?
We're going to blame it on daylight savings. We had a special that we did on ourselves.
And, Flavius.
So with that, and with a special thanks to our friends in Muggerville.
Oh, Muggerville. We should really go back. Maybe we can spend about half of next issue, since or some of next issue, since we only have like four years to cover. That we can go back and discuss the Muggerville through the decades. what Muggerville was like, you know, what Muggerville was like in the 70s, the 80s, the 90s.
I think it would be like one of those shows, you know, where they do like, you know, like Walking with Dinosaurs. Or
we can imagine. Yeah.
Well, like where you, you know, the first episode is always, it tells you exactly what you're going to see on every episode that follows.
Exactly.
The first episode almost doesn't count. It's like a preview. So we'll probably do is the reverse and kind of give you what we have of this current decade and then kind of go back and touch on things we missed or things we thought of too late, and of course our friends in Muggerville.
So here's what we got. Like Cole was saying, check us out, JCU at thejedicoleuniverse.com. Don't forget that we have a YouTube channel. If you search for the Jedi Cole Universe, we got lots of stuff on there. If you jump on Instagram and you search for hashtag any of these four things, HKC, JCU, Jedi Cole Universe, or Hey Kids Comics, you'll get a lot of content there as well. Did you talk about Cap Texas?
I did not.
All right, let's roll out on Cap Texas.
I will also, I believe, when this one airs, I believe tomorrow I will be at the North Texas Comic Book Show.
Yep.
Or I'm dead wrong about the date. So do check Convention Awareness Project Texas at www.cap-tx.info, I-N-F-O. To check out all the conventions in the state of Texas the rest of this year, and I'm also starting to put up the 2015 listings.
Already. So yeah.
That'll start to grow, but check and see if you see in the This Weekend section of the 2014 listings, the North Texas Comic Book Show. I'll be there. If you don't, it was already too late.
So, with all that being said, join us next week for the terrible teens, and remember to buy, collect, and enjoy comic books. Find your favorites, share with friends, talk it up. It's enjoyable. So say goodnight, Cole.
Good night, everybody. And at the end of this decade, we'll be back to recap this decade with a follow-up to this next week's show.
To this decade with next decade, but this decade. Good night, everybody.
You just got me feeling so free. We're gonna celebrate and dance so free. One more time, you just got me feeling so free. We're gonna celebrate and dance so free. One more time, you just got me feeling so free. We're gonna celebrate and dance so free. One more time, you just got me feeling so free. We're gonna celebrate and dance so free. One more time, you just got me feeling so free. We're gonna